Hey, this is Hal Sparks. You know me from I Love the 80s, VH1,
Talk Soup, Lab Rats, Queers Folk,
and that's Richard Hunter.
We're both musicians, we're both comedians, and we both have the same favorite member of KISS.
Welcome to the Double Neck Podcast.
Is that what we're calling it?
We're talking about some of the greatest music ever made with a lot of the people who made it.
I love the 80s, I love the 90s, I love the 70s.
We're two hosts with 10 strings between us.
You're listening to the Double Neck Podcast. All right, Hal, the topic is, well, it's your topic, so I'm going to let you introduce this.
Well, there's a difficulty that bands come up against, which is, a band just between two members, you know, the John and Paul, Paul and Gene world, a lot of times there's, two main members of a band, and then somebody gets booted, or it's hard enough to keep those two main people together. We talked a little bit last time about like lead singers and guitar players and how they often, are the dueling front people of a band.
Jagger and Richards.
Yep.
Steve Eddie and Dave. Tyler and Joe Perry.
Exactly. Yep. So that becomes getting just those two together is, and keeping them together consistently over the course of a band, can be fairly impossible. Much less the replacement artists who come in and pick up the slack in another instrument. And there's areas where, it's a seamless fit. Oftentimes drummers, which is why they end up being more hired guns than anybody, it's an easy fit. They can learn the songs and they're way in the back, so they don't really interfere. Whereas the bass player's got to sing back up and he might be a little more, as far as the support structure characters, that becomes a little tougher. But then there are these replacement moments where they try to replace one of the pivotal people in the band, and it is either a colossal flop or a miraculous turnaround for the band. And so I want to discuss this time a couple of areas where, the eithers and the ors.
All right.
Because I've got some favorites. A lot of times the most popular singer in a band sometimes is the second singer.
Yeah.
Jonathan from Korn was the second singer in Korn.
Now, let me ask you a ground rule on that.
Yeah.
When we say second singer, or for that matter, second guitar player or whatever, where are you saying from the time the band did its first rehearsal in a garage? Are you talking about like from the time the first record came out?
Well, I was using that as an example because I think really Korn took off when that happened.
Yeah.
But in the case of like AC/DC, for example, it's probably the most obvious replacement singer taking over somebody that was already a career. Mm-hmm. Already there, had Bon Scott not passed away, AC/DC would have probably been every bit as popular over time with a little bit of variation. I mean, obviously the Back in Black album wouldn't have happened because that song was about his hearse, essentially.
Mm-hmm.
But the rest of the repertoire, the Angus and Malcolm aspect of it with Bon Scott's voice, I think still would have been superstar level powerful had he not passed.
Yeah.
But then what do you do when your amazingly popular singer passes away? And can you reignite that magic? Is it even possible? Should you even try? Is it wrong to do it? Is always the big question. A lot of fans, when the lead singer goes, there's a thing like make another band. Don't even think about, Alice in Chains, probably one of the most, obvious answers to that as well. And there's jury's still out to some degree.
All right.
And, I love the band and I like the music they've been putting out. But is it really Alice in Chains together? Or is it, a sort of modern version of Jerry Cantrell's solo stuff with a relative sound-alike singer? Because it's over time, it seems like their singer has started to sound more like Jerry than Lane.
Mm. Start with AC/DC.
Yes.
Okay, because that on my list was, we'll just go back and forth with our examples, and that right there for me was tied, of all the examples I could think of, as the tied as the number one success story.
Yeah.
And I take myself back to the time when I became aware of AC/DC, and it was right about the Back in Black album.
Mm-hmm.
Bon Scott was a little bit before my time, and so only by a few years.
Mine too. But I mean, I liked what was it? I'm blitzing on it now, but the one where they play bagpipes in it.
Long Way to the Top.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so, That was probably my real first introduction, because that was on MTV or at least on the radio.
Yeah.
That I was familiar. I mean, obviously, Dirty Deeds or those may have come later, but that's the one I remember hearing the most in the States. Anyways,
I was familiar first with Back in Black, and then I went back and got the Bon Scott albums. Now, through doing that, Bon Scott became my favorite of the two lead singers. He was the favorite for me more for his lyrical style. Like, I just saw him more as more of a rock and roll poet. I thought his lyrics were clever.
Very much a character, like a Bukowski kind of a human being, and met that kind of an end in some ways.
Yeah.
And I hear where you're coming from.
Yeah. So I later on preferred those records, but I had to go back and get them because the one that was contemporarily released for me at my age was Back in Black. And then I saw AC/DC numerous times with Brian Johnson, but of course never with Bon Scott. So I did not really, I just read this book about a year ago, this Bon Scott book, I think it was called Highway to Hell, I did not realize that AC/DC wasn't tremendously popular in the United States with Bon Scott compared to how popular they got with Brian Johnson. I didn't realize that until years later because I was a kid.
Right.
You know, when it happened, I see this band, I figure, well, they've always been big.
Right.
But to find out that Bon Scott he really missed out on the global phenomenon.
Sure. Well, he was responsible. His death was essentially the pivot point that made them world renowned.
Yeah.
Because not only did it inspire the Back in Black record and rejuvenate the band into they had to, soldier forth. And a lot of times that will happen with a band. Mm-hmm. It'll either devastate you or it'll make, renew your joie de vivre in that regard. But literally, the song Back in Black is probably the most world-renowned AC/DC song of all time, even though, there are many other songs with them. Both with Brian Johnson and Bon Scott that are classics.
Mm-hmm.
The icon song for AC/DC, for most people, and I'm not talking to fans here, but most people worldwide is Back in Black.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's about essentially his hearse ride, his death, his being in a black suit for his funeral, this turnaround. So he inspired it, so he couldn't have been there for it. In that regard, that pivot moment.
So the idea being that in terms of replacing a singer, now that's an example where you're talking about a band that already has massive success in, I guess, some parts of the world and is on the cusp of this global phenomenon. That becomes, we have to put somebody in here to at least maintain the level of success that we have now. We'll probably talk about other examples where it's a band that maybe is looking at it like, hey, not even a lot of people know who we are, but we've got to keep what momentum we have going rather than have it stall out. So I think that is
the greatest success story, or at least tied. You were saying tied with
who? Now, my tie is Van Halen. Because,
all right.
Replacing David Lee Roth with Sammy Hagar. Now, again, positioning statement. For me, I see him really as two different bands.
I agree.
Other than, Eddie Van. But even in the Sammy Hagar era, the synthesizers and all that stuff has started to come in. So I see them as two different bands.
Mm-hmm.
Of the two bands, if you told me these were two different bands that had nothing in common, I would prefer the the David Lee Roth Van Halen.
Mm-hmm.
But I looked this up one time. I think they actually had more commercial success and record sales with Sammy Hagar than they did.
That often happens a lot, though. That's a tee-up thing. Because, like I've said, bad medicine is technically Bon Jovi's biggest hit ever.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is 100% because the lead up that Slippery When Wet created when people listened to, you know, You Give Love a Bad Name and Living on a Prayer, that there was so much, all the stations, all the radio stations across the country were ready for new Bon Jovi.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they probably got three times the radio play on that single.
Yeah.
And it played more because people were waiting for new Bon Jovi and kind of almost hypnotized into, here it comes, this is the great stuff. And in retrospect, it's frankly not. I hate that song. But your biggest hit is usually fueled by the one right before it. And in the case of, you know, like Sammy Hagar and Van Halen, like the loss of Van Halen as a band was, you know, was rough for a lot of people. As breakups go, that was one of the ones where you're like, God damn it, they were so much fun. And that's gone now for good, maybe. And then you're like, who can come in with as much, you know, as big a grin and as big a blonde hair as David Lee Roth? And the answer is no one. But Sammy Hagar has his own energy that way. And never, even solo or in Montrose, was launched the way, to the level that he was of quality, you know, where people recognized him.
He was a different kind of, you know, he always had this sort of like beach bum vibe. David Lee Roth was the rock star.
Yes.
David Lee Roth was the larger than life, you know, front man,
borderline male stripper.
Star.
Right.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Whereas here comes Sammy Hagar in like weightlifter jams, you know, puff pants.
Yeah.
And, you know, was more like the guy who would be drinking beer with you at the show than the guy watching the show. Like, you know, where you're like, hey, they let this guy from the audience up on stage and he was terrific. And he could hit these really high notes. But it was more that kind of a vibe. And I think probably those are the types of songs that they wrote in that regard.
Yeah, well, that being said, with Sammy Hagar, when you think about what he, and in this way, I might make a case that he actually brought more to the equation than the Brian Johnson, the Bon Scott to Brian Johnson transition in this sense.
Yeah.
Sammy Hagar, for one, had a solo catalog.
Yeah.
All song and the songs fit. You know, you can play, you know, There's Only One Way to Rock, Three Lockbox, whatever. You can play those in Van Halen and they fit.
Yes.
So he brings that to the table as a contribution. The other thing is he's a guitar player. And while he's not Eddie Van Halen, he is now able to play guitar in a band at a time that is known for having arguably the world's reigning greatest guitar player, but a guy who's gotten away from the guitar sound in favor of the synthesizer.
Sure.
So he's able to get a little more guitar and back into that, even if it's just rhythm
guitar.
Right,
and also because the rhythm guitar is there, it gives it that more like anchored rock sound than the single guitar player, especially a single guitar player who solos a lot, like Vito Bratta and White Lion as an example, who was honestly like, and I love his work, but fully soloing half the song, you know. I think with AC/DC there was continuity. That's the tough part when you're replacing a singer anyways. You're like, we got to get a guy who can sing like this guy did and do our stuff.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of bands, when they fuck that off, it really pisses me off. Like when you find somebody, you know, like we were talking a little bit about Sebastian Bach and replacing Sebastian, you have to find somebody who can hit those notes, because if you do a dud version of those, you know, soaring vocals, as a fan, I'm going to be disappointed. You at least have to have somebody who can pull it off. And Queensryche, I think, found a dude who could pull it off. But in the case of, you know, Bon Scott and Brian Johnson, it wasn't an exact match, but you found two gravel singers who could hit some notes. And there's an argument that Brian Johnson could hit higher notes, certainly, than Bon. So he leveled them up a little bit, whereas Sammy Hagar and David Lee Roth as singers literally baritone to tenor. Difference, because David Lee Roth is a baritone, hands down. Like he has his squeal, but basically he's a baritone singer. And at the top edge of his chest voice, which is the only place he goes, is the bottom range of. The opening. You know, and full disclosure, I have currently joined and am fronting a band called Nerd Halen, where we are doing the catalog. As a cover band of Van Halen stuff.
Both Hagar and...
Yeah, that's right. And over the course of it...
Roth.
Okay. Yeah, exactly. It's basically a bunch of... The premises is kind of in the comedic world of, you know, Steel Panther and the like Boogie Nights kind of zone of things, where it's a bunch of nerds who've done the math and they've realized that the easiest and most direct route to getting laid for nerds would be, after a huge amount of math, being a Van Halen cover band. That is the quickest route.
Yeah.
And so that's the joke, is that there's enough sexy songs to draw the girls out, and there's enough heartfelt songs because of the Hagar years to lock them in.
Oh, okay.
And that's the kind of running gag for the show.
Now, would you be wearing the jam shorts and then changing into the buttless chaps based on the set
list? Sort of the other way around. Yeah, there'll be a little bit, but it's the nerd version. So I will be wearing like a nerd short sleeve shirt with a tie compression shirt kind of idea that gets torn off. But the idea is we're developing it now. But the point is, I've been going over this catalog and learning these songs because I can do the whole range vocally myself. And listening, you know, you'd be intimidated in some ways by like the range of Sammy Hagar is something that I think a lot of people underestimate.
Yeah.
And it's not even in the ballpark sonically of what David Lee Roth was doing.
Right. But, yeah. So, okay. So there you've got an example, too, of somebody.
That's where the two band thing
happens. And there's another thing, too, where you've got somebody who can come in and go, okay, I can do everything that was done before, but I can also now do things that could not be done
exactly
before.
which is what made it work. And usually, unfortunately, the opposite is true. Unless you're doing a, you know, pulling a Journey where you just find a dude on YouTube who can hit the notes and just go, he sounds almost exactly like our old guy.
Right.
Who cares if he's got charisma or can write a song or is a musician per se or whatever. He's a karaoke star, we'll grab him.
What else you got? By the way, mine are not all singers.
Yeah, so, mine aren't either.
Okay. What's that? So you, I saw your AC/DC and countered you a Van Halen. So what say you?
Yeah. So this is an interesting move around because this is one of my favorite artists, and both solo and with a band. And a very flexible artist as far as the quality of work. And certainly a tumultuous life, but and I have always had a chip on my shoulder when the purists don't let somebody succeed in the role. There's been a bunch of that where like somebody replaces a guy, and the hardcore fans, especially when it's like artier music, they'll never forget that they went commercial, they sold out, they jettisoned their real art roots and replaced them with somebody who would get them a top 10 hit or something like that. And in the case of Genesis and Phil Collins, who I love both personality-wise, musically, I think the diversity of the music that Phil Collins has created over the course of his life is nothing short of extraordinary. But then him, you know, booting Peter Gabriel, Peter Gabriel moves out and they're like looking for a singer. And then they realize, well, our drummer can hit the notes that our singer was doing.
Yeah.
And we know we can deal with him. We already like him, and he can sing and play at the same time.
He was right here all along.
He was, it's like Mary Stuart, Master Antonio from Some Kind of Wonderful, you know? He just looked right over the top of her head. She wasn't as tall as Leah Thompson, but there she was. Yeah. So, in the case of Phil Collins, you know, and it drove, to some degree, it drove Peter Gabriel into the wilderness a little bit more than he probably was willing to do, because he was going to leave to be more arty and ended up probably with more commercial success because Phil Collins rolls in and laps the guy. You know, the Yellow Album is one of my favorite records of all time. It's got Mama on it and Just a Job I Do. And, you know, like, again, the diversity of sonically on that record is very close to, you know, like, the diversity of Queen, for example, and I've just always loved the, you know, Phil Collins' voice in that thing, and I always felt like he did that thing. He almost, you know, and obviously the Sammy Hagar comparison works very well in this version of Genesis. In England, anyways, and a little bit in the States, they were starting to really get a big push.
Yeah,
and then Peter Gabriel decides it's too commercial for him, even with what he was doing. Which, you know, a lot of people love, I felt was aimless and kind of jerked back and forth. And when Phil Collins moved to the main singing role, he replaced the singer and remained the drummer.
Yeah.
And in a classic movement of, you know, of rock, redefined Genesis as a worthwhile band. Now, you know, they became, you know, a punchline because of American Psycho. and when they went full commercial, you know, to where they were basically writing stuff that could be a Michelob ad with Tonight, 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 for example, or those, which were all great. Still love those songs. I don't hate on them for that. But they, you know, over the course of the 80s, like Phil Collins took that moment, took that, okay, I used to sit in the back, and now I'm going to be the singer, and turned it into one of the greatest commercially and artistically successful music moments in American history, really.
I think he gets overlooked. I had not thought of that example, and now that you talk about an example of where the person came already from within the band, I'd have to sit to think of another example. I doubt I could think of another commercially successful of an example like that. All right, so let me give you one that I don't think worked. How about that? Because they can't all be winners.
Oh, I've got a couple of those, no question.
All right. John Corabi replacing Vince Neil in Motley Crue.
Right.
Now,
that's another one of those voice moments like I was talking about, too. Like,
yeah. Now, here's a couple of things to look at. By the way, I saw John Corabi with Dead Daisies like 6 months ago. He sounded great. I mean, he sounded a lot better than the last time I saw Vince Neil.
Right.
So you know, of the two who held up better, John Corabi's probably got an edge there. But Motley Crue is one of those bands that, I mean, first of all, we got to look at what was going on. Okay, Vince Neil goes out of the band, but that's also at a time, and they put out the eponymously titled Motley Crue album with John Corabi. They made one record with him, and they made it in the early '90s, where grunge has already come along. Metal's going to have a hard time any day of the week anyway, and Corabi one didn't sound like Vince Neil, which. Right. To your point a minute ago about you got to have somebody who's going to at least sound close enough to sing all the classics. But the other thing was the record, I think, I don't know that it I'm not saying it went full grunge, but they definitely were trying to do something a little more amenable to the times. You add all that up, plus this weird X factor, and I've got this with a couple of bands on my list, and this is one of them, and I don't know exactly how to quantify it other than just you know it when you see it, is that in some cases, whether it be original four members or original five, whatever, you just got to have them all. Motley Crue to me is a band that does not work if you don't have those four guys.
Sure.
And this was an example of that. And, you know, there were some other, there was that time that Tommy Lee quit and they had the female drummer for a minute, stuff like that. But just, it doesn't, you know, there may be a lot better players out there that you could switch in and out, but doesn't matter. In the case of that band, shouldn't do it. And to me, Corabi in for Vince Neil was a failed experiment. And then that's why, you know, it, And everybody came to their senses and realized, much like what we were talking about previously, about bands that just can't, for the life of them, you know, why could we not get along well enough
to just do that,
make this thing work? And that, fortunately, that's how they ended.
Yeah, and I agree completely with Motley Crue on that one. I think that is interesting that they uniquely as a band probably have that going on more than almost anybody. Now, I think the same thing is true to some degree of the original lineup of Guns N' Roses, and that everything after, including sort of adding Izzy, adding a keyboard player, any additional stuff always seemed a little like, who are these other people? What are they doing here?
Yeah.
You know, and you know, in the case of where they're, you know, backup artists or their secondary guitar players, like all the people who are allegedly in Nirvana, for example, which, you know, like Foo Fighters talks about, we're having a Nirvana reunion and it's like six people, everybody but Kurt, essentially, and that there were other people who toured with us. I don't believe that's still people replacing people in Nirvana. Those were support musicians for touring live, holding it together because clearly you're lead singer guitar player is throwing his guitar all over the fucking place and there's no sonic continuity musically that's going on there. In the case of Motley Crue, you're absolutely right. Those four guys are sort of irreplaceable. I think to some degree, you know, had Kiss lasted longer with their initial lineup, they'd have been in the same situation. And in many ways, they went back to it just to tap the side of the pool, you know, and then they could, you know, move out into, you know, into switching people around. Sonically, obviously, singers and guitar players, that through line, so that at least there's sonic continuity with the band, is really what matters. And singers are the hardest one, because finding a singer who sounds like what the guy sounds like, even just, again, tonally, if they can hit the notes, and they might be stylistically off, like, was it Paul Rodgers joining Queen for those shows?
I had that,
like,
on my list, too.
Like, I can't do it. Like, it makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I had that on my list, too, because it was, I mean, we'll just touch on that one real quickly, but you're talking about, first of all, Queen is also in one of those categories for me that the person who is out of the band is so transcendent.
Yes.
Of it. It's like Eddie, it's like Van Halen without Eddie Van Halen.
Right.
I mean, there's just no, it's Freddie Mercury is, if you don't think he's the greatest frontman in history, you've got to have him in your top three. I mean, it's a hotly contested debate.
The band called Queen largely as a spoof on the fact that he was as queeny as he was, and his exuberant personality, and that he was, while being very effeminate, owned the space. Like, it was literally that.
Yeah.
That, and it came to define them.
And Paul Rodgers, being a great frontman of Free and Bad Company and all that, I say frontman, but great, great singer, is just different. It's just totally different. It's apples and oranges. And to me, Queen was one of those bands that should have just done like Joy Division did. They just turned into New Order after was it Ian Curtis?
Right.
That was his name, right?
I
Ian
think
Curtis.
So.
Yeah. But you know, they I mean, if they lost a member that they just felt like, okay, we can't continue to be the band that we were. The rest of us want to keep playing. Let's just call it something different.
Right.
And then you move on, and then it's not so important of who you get to replace. But that was one that I had on my list.
Yeah, that I remember when that happened. I was like, it was one of my biggest what the fuck what? Like, you know, it made no sense to me. If only because you're like, maybe you find a woman with the range that can hit all the stuff that Freddie could hit. Maybe you have guest singers like Alice in Chains did for a little while, where they were like coming out and like Hetfield was singing for them and a bunch of other people while they rotated through and kind of got back on their feet. But this idea that like it was really for, in many ways, it almost felt like people like, I'm a Brian May fan and I want to see him play the Queen songs live, and I really don't care who's barking their way through it.
Yeah.
You know, I remember when I heard that was, I thought it was a joke. It made no sense. And it's sad when Paul Rodgers is an amazing singer. He is, you know, there are people where they have musical importance. Their quality is very, you know, classic, but not there.
Yeah.
That's the weird part. And there's a ton of the, you know, that comes up with a lot of 80s hair metal lead singer, you know, because they'll find some dude that they just know with a way lower gravelly range, you know, and, you know, in the sort of, you know, Tracy Guns-ish, you know, lead singer-ish zone, where like it's not quite up there, but, you know, it's punk, it's mean, it sounds gravelly. We're more street. This is this is us going back to our roots, whatever they want to tell themselves, when in reality they're like, these notes are never going to be hit. And the audience is there. You know, it's like if you had, like, you're – lead guitar player had the top 12, you know, like 8 frets of his guitar removed.
Yeah, yeah.
And he could no longer play past the ninth fret. And you're just like, we're going to go see him play live. He can never play past the ninth fret, though. His fingers are too big, like, anymore. And you would, as a musician, like, if you went and saw Eddie Van Halen with half a neck on his guitar, you'd be like, it's cool, but, and I'm glad he's alive and playing, but what the fuck is this? And I felt like that was the situation with Paul Rodgers. Like, that's not the right place for this.
Yeah. Yeah, that was a weird one. All right. Yeah. I guess you...
We kind of overlapped a little bit on that.
That was yours, though. That was yours. So I'll throw one out here.
Okay.
Let's go non-singers for a second.
Yes.
Because
I have one that still pisses me off.
Okay. How about this one? Jason Newsted for Cliff Burton.
Yeah.
Now, Cliff Burton, of course, tragically dies on the Masters of Puppets tour. He
asleep in the bus. The bus crashes.
Yeah, and then falls over on top of him. Freak accident.
Yep.
Jason Newsted replaces him. Now, in terms of giving it the yay or nay vote, musically, okay. I think Cliff Burton was a great player, and he mattered a lot on those early mm-hmm. those first three Metallica records. But
right.
you know, it wasn't a fail in terms of Newsted musically. However, I think it hurt the band dynamically because if you look at it in retrospect, and James Hetfield and Lars Ulrich are the first to admit this, they didn't treat him like an equal member coming in. They still had all kinds of weird processing to do over Cliff Burton's death. So they just kind of, you know, put him, he took a back seat to the rest of them, to the point that, you know, literally in the mix on And Justice for All, there's little to no bass. I mean, they just kind of dropped him right out of the mix, right?
Yeah, right.
Okay. That being said, where I think that came home to roost a few years after that was that when Metallica started making what, in my opinion, were some big musical missteps.
Mm-hmm.
The Load, Reload era, Saint Anger, you yep. know, that kind of stuff, where Newsted ultimately, that's where he had his exit from the band.
Mm-hmm.
He did not have the clout in the band
to talk them out of it.
Exactly. And yes. I think Cliff Burton, had he been around, his vote
that's interesting.
Would have avoided some nonsense.
Right. I like Jason Newsted.
Mm-hmm.
I'm a big fan of his talent. I think he was a decent dude. I thought he got the shit end of the stick for most of those years. Mm-hmm. I thought he was, you know, musically was he both sang and played as a full-on contributor of Metallica that mm-hmm. was kind of undervalued. He was definitely under the shadow of a dead artist who was, in many ways, had a natural talent that was engaging, you know, because Anastasia Pulling Teeth and that guitar or that bass riff that everybody is kind of thinks of, you know, when they think mm-hmm. of Cliff Burton. And then the opening, like, some of the things where you're like, oh, that opening isn't guitar, that's bass.
Yeah.
You know, those things, that was Cliff.
Mm-hmm.
And he was that engaged a member of the band. And then Newsted comes in because he's replacing somebody who's passed away and is always carrying that weight. Now, when I always feel like, as a fan, if somebody croaks, whoever replaces them gets a free pass.
Yeah.
No bullshit, no booing, no I wish, no wondering. The dude is dead, the woman is dead, whoever it is.
It's unavoidable,
and it's not the fault. This is not like they moved in and kicked the person out. Like, mm-hmm. I still think there's a reason why Peter Gabriel fans might hold a grudge against Phil Collins. But the idea that you would be pissed at Jason Newsted,
mm-hmm.
you know, who was great in Flotsam and Jetsam, was, you know, pulled out of relative obscurity in bands that were similar sonically to Metallica, a good fit musically, would somehow carry some weight, like, fuck you, like he was the driver of the bus or something. Mm-hmm. It was really odd that he was treated that way. And like I said, I've always liked Jason's energy, all of his interviews. You could tell he was like an anchored human being most mm-hmm. of the time and just took way more shit than he deserved to take. I really felt for Jason, you know, in that thing. And it's, you know, Robert Trujillo, who's also a really good dude, mm-hmm. by the way, came in a way that, because it was almost like they had taken out all of their anger and problems on Jason Newsted, that he could come in free and clear.
Yeah, interesting. If you had flipped those two around, Newsted would probably be thriving in the band right now because he would have benefited
Trujillo
from the older,
like
wiser, more mature.
That's right.
Burton, Hammett, Ulrich, and Hammett for that matter. But I've always gotten the idea, without any inside knowledge, that you know, Hetfield and Ulrich are the alphas in that.
Sure.
Situation.
Oh, no question. I mean, you watch Some Kind of Monster, yeah. which has got one of the singular great camera shots of any documentary in history, where they're all talking because they're going through therapy and all that horse shit. And Ulrich's standing up, Hetfield sitting down, Kirk Hammett is at the edge of the couch, and the camera's just cutting across Hammett at the two of them arguing. And he goes, you're just not, you know, you're just mad at me because I'm, you know, I can't express myself or something. And Ulrich goes, no, I'm just mad at you because you're a fucking dick or whatever. And you see Hammett's hand just forehead like that, and the shot goes through his arm and is literally V8ing himself like, oh, fuck, this just went south. And he's filming the other two arguments through this little crux in his elbow. You could not have set it up better.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, so I really, as a fan, while I enjoyed, you know, the Black Album a decent amount, mm-hmm. and I love the new Metallica stuff, for mm-hmm. the record,
mm-hmm.
I did not like or care for the mid-zone 90s stuff, neither. Including the Black Album as much. I know mm-hmm. it's one of the most popular albums of all time. It's, for me as a fan, as a listener, what I like to hear, you know, I'm way more in the Ride the Lightning Master of Puppets camp. There's certainly some Kill 'Em All fans out there who think it was all downhill from that. But I always, and I think maybe how I feel about those records is knowing from both interviews and other stuff over time, because it was contemporaneous. You weren't hearing like, oh, dude, when they were doing those albums, they treated Newstead mm-hmm. like shit. Mm-hmm. Like, you could tell at mm-hmm. the time. And so you're watching, you're like, why the fuck are they shitting on this dude? Like, mm-hmm. he's, you know, he's there to play. He's there to do what he's supposed to do. So I always felt like, I think those albums maybe even tainted for me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and the same thing is true, and this is my next one, is anybody who replaces John Sykes in Whitesnake.
Mm. That's a long list of people.
It's a long list
of people. I hope you're not planning to name them all. We'll have to make this a two-part episode.
Right, but it's, you know, I'm... That main Whitesnake record, you know, the one that really set them, you know, put them
87.
Yeah.
86, with, 87.
Yeah, right. With the Still of the Night and Bad, Bad Boys and Crying in the Rain and the remake of Here I Go Again.
The one that has John Sykes all over.
That's right. Yeah, one where he wrote all those riffs and played all those, and the solos are so distinctly him. Mm-hmm. And then he's not in the fucking videos. Mm-hmm.
He wasn't in the band by the time the record came out.
By the time they, shot it. And I remember not finding out that wasn't him in the video.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going, like, that's kind of a dick move, like, after the fact, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's what made me discover Blue Murder.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I sought out finding Blue Murder.
I think at that time there was, and I'm just telling you why I think it happened. I'm not saying right or wrong or whatever. But at that time, if you think about MTV and the videos and the visuals and all that, mm-hmm. in Coverdale, you already had a guy who was a little bit older than the other guys in those types of bands for the most part, but they still, you know, frosted the tips of his hair. They got the look together mm-hmm. and everything. But I think that, and Tommy Aldridge, for that matter, was an older dude.
Yeah, like he looked like Mick Mars' older uncle. Right.
But still, they put together visually the package that, and of course they put Tawny Katane on the hood of the car and everything, and made the package that would work for that. Now, I mean, does that mean that John Sykes couldn't have adapted to that? I'm not saying he couldn't have, but I just think that at that time there was a whole lot of things that were factoring in as intangibles that maybe in a different decade.
It seemed weird that, like, it almost seemed like he was too big and pretty to be on camera next to Coverdale and made him look younger, you know, made him look older by standing there, you know, and he's a big horsey dude. Like, you know,
I don't know. I don't know what was that. And I'll tell you, you know, to fast forward to modern day, Sykes has been a largely inactive player, and he's been rumored to have this new record coming out for years now.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw another press release about it where they're saying, oh, this 2019 will be the year. It is coming out, and we'll see. But, yeah, I mean, that's an example of something that, and, you know, there's other examples. This is maybe a list for another day, but there's other examples of where somebody just – either their band broke up or they got kicked out of a band, fired, whatever, and it just kind of derailed them. I mean, they just kind of never really got back on track with anybody else or themselves.
That happens to actors, too. Like, you know, you get your show gets canceled or you get replaced by somebody else, and then that's just that.
Yeah.
The woman who played the mom in the original Back to the Future, because originally it was Eric Stoltz who was playing the Michael J. Fox character, he got fired. And they had to replaced him with Michael J. Fox. They had to replace the mom because she didn't look like they picked a redhead because she was going to look like Eric Stoltz.
Hmm.
And when they replaced her, I don't think she ever worked again really much.
Didn't know that.
Because it was rough. I mean, you get your shot. You're in this huge, you know, production, and then all of a sudden, because the guy playing your son is a dick, you lose your job.
That's a tough one. I mean, to put Sykes on the list, I get where you're going. It's a tough one for me to put on the list, just in the sense of Whitesnake is such a Coverdale vehicle. I mean, it's just become that.
But because but think of what hits have they had since that record?
None.
That mix was good. That was a good mix. Whether that was the tension of the two of them or whatever the hell was going on, the mixture of those two things. Sykes was the magic sauce that delivered Coverdale in the form that he needed to be delivered in. Mm-hmm. And by jettisoning that out of ego or whatever the fuck was going on, the reality is Whitesnake never recovered from it either.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, you know, it's one of those things like, why can't the bands that broke up get back together again? You can argue that that's exactly what was going
and
on.
And that's a tough one. That's going to be a tough one too for Sykes to watch, because then what Whitesnake is driven on now is the success of those years.
No
and
question.
Going out and doing that.
Playing
that
those songs live. Right.
Yeah.
And by the way, when Sykes does them live, holy shit, they sound great. Mm-hmm. And he sings and plays at the same time. I like David Coverdale.
Yeah.
But Sykes can pull it off. I forget whether that was mine.
Yeah, that's you.
Yeah. Okay. So
I will let's accentuate the positive here again for a second.
Yes.
Ronnie James Dio for Ozzy Osbourne. Now, to me, although different singers, this is another. Well, I can't draw a parallel comparison Hagar to Roth, except in the sense that I think in terms of range and depth that Dio one-upped Ozzy in that sense. Now, I see that, again, like two different bands.
Totally.
They definitely did not adhere to the idea that they were going to get somebody who would sound like the original person. But all that being said, they could have done a whole lot worse in terms of, to me, the Dio years were strong years, and a lot of those songs, if I were to make my, you know, top 20 Black Sabbath songs, you would have some solid Dio representation on
sure
them. he was to me, he's one of the greatest voices in metal.
Yes, you know? I agree.
And I don't put Ozzy in that category, but Ozzy is Ozzy. I mean, there's not as
in range
or
capability, but is an iconic sonic status where like no one else, you know
it's him.
Yeah, that's right. And there's a lot to be said for that.
No, that's true.
Yeah.
I just, it's saying that, okay, Black Sabbath went the route of, okay, we're going to put somebody in who is a, is a stronger singer. We've got a big catalog that we've, you know, built this career on that
it
alone at that point would have been enough to get it into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're going to embark upon this entirely new turn. And I think Dio did that for him. So it's, it's maybe not, you know, could they have gone with someone that could both create new things with them and sound more like what Ozzy sounded like? I mean, I guess that person would have been out there somewhere. I don't know who they would have been, but I think it sure worked for him. And again, being the age that I was, where Ozzy's Black Sabbath was again a few years before my time.
Yep.
My contemporary reference was Dio and Black Sabbath, and Ozzy as a solo artist. But then going back and listening to all the old Ozzy material, I didn't have any problem reconciling the two. And when Ozzy came to town, I went to see him. And when Black Sabbath came to town, I went to see them. And that's the bottom line.
Yeah, it's interesting that there was no real hate for either of them in those circumstances. And I think it's it had a lot to do, again, with a more capable singer taking over the role.
Mm-hmm.
When you are in much safer territory, all bands who may be listening to the sound of my voice. Mm-hmm. If you find someone who is more capable than the person you are replacing, then less.
Because talent's always going to show.
Yes.
And even if it's going to take some getting used to, and the new guy, isn't a clone of the old guy.
Yep.
The stuff that they are going to generate as a new unit mm-hmm. is going to be something that you're going to appreciate.
Right.
Very
and,
likely.
And at least, you know, there'll be this, like, at least I know he can nail the notes I'm expecting. Mm-hmm. That is really the hardest part of it, because in a lot of these situations, you know, if you can't, If the original singer can't get there, it's depressing. Mm-hmm. If they've replaced the dude with somebody younger, especially, and that dude can't hit it, you're like, this show is a wash.
Yeah, yeah.
Forget it. Yeah. You know. Those are my kind of, you know, my main ones.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of rotating people that were through bands like Lynyrd Skynyrd and stuff like that, and I wouldn't go into those areas, because especially in bigger bands or bands that have like multiple singers, multiple guitar players and stuff like that, like Styx or something, like mm-hmm. the rotation in that circumstance. No.
These are what we're talking about are examples where the remaining members are sitting around going, okay, whatever we do, we've got to think about it real carefully, because everyone is going to notice.
Yeah.
This is going to be really obvious one way or another. Well, here's one we can team up on, because this has multiple examples within the same band, and we'll just go in chronological order. This is a Kiss rabbit hole.
Sure.
I'll ask you to hold my hand as we
descend. Yeah.
So let's go in chronological order. Eric Carr for Peter Criss. Now, Eric Carr was a great drummer. I think he brought an energy to Kiss that from behind the kit that wasn't there before. And Kiss is such a unique example for me, though, because you're talking about the four original faces and the makeup and the character personas and all that. But I did, you know, Kiss was my mm-hmm. first band, my first favorite band. And so,
me too.
So I was, you know, I remember, in fact, I still have the People magazine
mm-hmm.
where Eric Carr was on the cover with Kiss, and they were in the I think they
Dynasty
might have
outfit.
Still been wearing the Dynasty outfits, even though Peter Criss was on the Dynasty album,
mm-hmm.
but they still kind of had those outfits on.
Because they were touring.
Yeah.
And he became the Fox during that
Yeah,
part.
But mm-hmm. that was the first time that I had ever seen that new makeup and everything. And I know that you know, Kiss over the years, Paul and Gene, modern day Kiss decision makers, have talked a lot about, well, you know, it got to a point, were we just going to keep creating new characters? Were we going to have the Frogman and, you know, mm-hmm. all that kind of stuff? But I didn't mind that.
Me neither.
I
even liked Vinny's Onk.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a second.
Yeah, I didn't mind that at all. So as much as it was at the time a guy coming in with new makeup, but also somebody who I think fit in really well once they took the makeup off and they really became part of the full-on 80s
mm-hmm.
glam metal movement, whatever that was, mm-hmm. he made that transition with them perfectly, probably in a way that Peter Criss wouldn't have.
Impossible.
Because
he was older. He was also mm-hmm. like the Mick Mars of the band in that regard. But also, Eric Carr, like, I would trade Eric Carr singing Young and Wasted live on the Animalized tour for 100 copies of Beth, hands down. Like, mm-hmm. The one big contribution for me for Peter Criss that was really, you know, that rang out when I was a kid was this sort of iconic look of the makeup initially.
Mm-hmm.
And then the and songs like Nothing to Lose, like mm-hmm. the old honky-tonkish Kiss stuff that Gene really pushed around mm-hmm. in his kind of wanting to be the Beatles mm-hmm. a lot. Beyond that, though, when it got harder and more interesting, the raspy voice, which Eric Carr had in spades, mm-hmm. I just would listen to songs like Strange Ways and feel like, you know what? Eric would have sung that equally as good.
Well, Kiss has been fortunate in that regard, because now Eric Singer also does a great job of that. So they've been fortunate in that regard. It's just such a weird,
they always pick raspy singers.
Yeah.
It's almost like they replace their drummers based on the Bon Scott Brian Johnson switchover. Like, they need to sonically be in the same kind of like smoke 20 packs a day zone.
It's just such a, it's, Kiss is such a an anomaly because of the characters and the makeup and all that. So you're talking about a situation, I mean, no other example are you going to come up with where you're like, you're looking at the contribution, you know, that a replacement member made for an exiting member and go, yeah, but that exiting member, he had that one outfit he always wore, and mm-hmm. that was a huge hit when you couldn't have that outfit on stage anymore. Like, but with the makeup, that plays a factor mm-hmm. into it. So, but at the time, all things being what they were, I thought Eric Carr to Peter Criss was a very smooth transition. And also, I think the first percussionist example that we're talking about. I don't think we've talked about a replacement drummer.
Yeah, not
far.
Really. I mean, Phil Collins had a sidecar drummer. It was named Clarence, the other guy who tours with Genesis.
Okay,
pardon me for
yeah.
not knowing he's the live
drummer.
Like when he comes
out from behind the kick.
Yeah, yeah, that they have a second drummer yeah. and they all play
really
together.
That, no. I mean, we're talking about...
He's like the Nirvana example I gave earlier. Yes.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I completely agree. All and right. I loved Eric Carr. I was yeah. I was a big fan of him as a musician and as a human being, and I was... After especially seeing the interview where Peter was kind of a dick and was going to move on to his own, as a Kiss fan when I was young even, I was like... The hell's wrong with this guy? Like, this is so fun, and this is what you've turned it into? What's wrong with you? And so when Eric came in and he was just like laughing and wearing the Fox makeup and all that kind of stuff, and then just fucking pounding those drums. And again, it's one of the he's the drummer equivalent of my singer rule. He can play everything plus.
Right, right. Yeah, because if you think about where they would eventually go and need to go and all that in the 80s, you know, Peter Criss, although he was perfect for the Kiss records that he was on because those were the Kiss records. Mm-hmm. So I don't have any. It's like arguing whether or not Mitch Mitchell was perfect for the Jimi Hendrix records. Yes, he was, because those were the records he was on, and
yes.
that was the sound. But Peter Criss was much more of a, you know, kind of a swing based drummer,
jazz
and that
drummer, right?
would not yeah. have worked moving into the
not at all. And
80s.
He played far too light for what they were kind of doing.
It wouldn't have worked on Animal.
Interestingly enough, the rule of can play everything, you know, plus. Didn't apply necessarily to Mark St. John, because while Mark St. John was a great 80s guitar player and very fast and, you know, was a quality guitar player, the Ace soulful stuff was, you know, and I never got to see him live, so I don't know if, you know, he would have pulled that stuff off. And I like the solos on
anyone
but
else.
They were totally different, you know.
And see, that right there, so let's get to Ace now, because my next chronological example of this is Vinnie Vincent for Ace Frehley. But what I always say about Ace...
Or the gaps in the songs were the first replacement. Let's just play music during that section and not have a solo while we're trying to figure it out. The first replacement for Ace Frehley was an extended musical section with no solo on three songs.
Or what I always say about Ace... is that you can hum every one of his solos, and that counts for something.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, you know, you can play a million notes a minute, but can I sing that back to you
that
I can a vocal melody? No. But with Ace Frehley, you could do – I could still do it to this day. Without even being able to play any of the solos, I can sing them back to you. So there's something to be said for that. But anyway, of course, Ace exits the band. Vinnie Vincent comes in and – that, of course, he's got the Ankh makeup that you mentioned for, I don't know, 6 months or something like that.
Which
before
I liked.
Lick It Up came
and
around.
If there was any reason to keep the makeup on, it was Vinnie Vincent's face, his real face.
Yeah.
Like, if there was a reason to go, let's not take the makeup right now off right now. Let's keep it on for another 6 years.
So this just reminds me real quick, because did you do the, when Kiss, it was in the mid-90s when they did the Kiss conventions. Did you go to one of those?
Yeah, yeah.
I went to the one that was in Dallas, and it was very cool. It was like Kiss would come down into the lobby of the ballroom of the hotel they were set up at, and they play acoustic set. But throughout the day, you could walk around and tour all their memorabilia. And boy, you can tell that that's a band who from day one believed wholeheartedly that they would eventually have a traveling museum exhibit. Because it's like, here's our copy of our first set list in pristine condition and all that. But
they knew that because in Kiss Exposed, I think it was, you know, when they first showed the inside of that you know, what was supposed to be the attic of the house they all live in the video or whatever. Mm-hmm. There was so much attention. I remember myself when he was Paul was walking around just like holding up dolls fans had made. Yeah. Here's a pair of old boots. Here's, you know, there's one of Gene's cod pieces, blah, blah, blah. But there was so much interest in that from fans. I remember watching it going, oh, my God, they still have all that shit. That's amazing. That I think that's what that sprung from.
The thing that I remember about though that convention, though, is that that's where I learned that Eric Carr was originally not going to be a fox. He was going to be the Falcon, I think it was.
Right.
And they had this mannequin, and they had like this sort of bird beak-looking makeup on. But the shoulder pads, instead of the fur, were these yellow feathers.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was imagining is like he was probably the Falcon right up until the first dress rehearsal, where they went through one song, and it's just feathers flying everywhere.
Well, because Paul had some outfits with feathers on, the black feathers or whatever, and apparently those were a pain in the ass.
Yeah, so anyway, he changed. But anyway, okay, so to Vinnie Vincent, your thoughts there. Vincent to end for Ace Frehley.
Interestingly enough, I thought Vinnie Vincent, for if you listen to his solo playing on like Invasion and you know his own stuff, which would later become the band Slaughter after he was replaced basically by his own band. Like that's an inversion of what we're talking about. We should talk about some people who started bands there and they were kicked out of and the band was more successful. That's an upcoming episode. That has to be. But in the case of Vinnie Vincent, if you listen to his solo, he's this crazy atonal shredder half the time, to the point where it's embarrassing and hysterical. But when he came in to play for Kiss, he was amazingly tasteful considering.
Mm-hmm.
Like he had that hired gun. What do you want exactly? I'll give you that.
Mm-hmm.
And so these, you know, the solos made sense.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't off the reservation. Mm-hmm. You know, and there's a feeling that, like, if he'd have been there for Animal Eyes, they would have gone in the Mark St. John zone, you know, of like, I'm sure that there had to be a moment where, oh, fuck, Mark can't play. Well, Vinny can play all this shit.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody went, fuck, I don't want to be around Vinny. Like, and that's how Bruce ended, you know, they always talk about how Bruce ended up in the band. Part of it had to be at least somebody floated the idea of, Vinny can play this. He's toured with us a little bit. And everybody going, no, you know, collectively. Mm-hmm. But the solos on Lick It Up, for example, are seamless with what I think Ace would have done almost in that same circumstance. It was a little bit, you know, stylistically different, but there was some soul in what was going on there. Those solos are legit for those songs, you know, and songs like, you know, the guitar playing on Exciter and other songs like that, which is still one of my favorite songs of all time. Those were distinctly Vinny's pick pattern and his style, but at the same time, you could match those albums up with Creatures and what had kind of, you know, which was, again, a little bit of Vinny and a little bit of nobody in those songs. So, I wish that had worked out to some degree.
The other example of that you have to look at in Kiss, and it's not Bruce Kulick in for Vinnie Vincent, because that's a replacement replacing a replacement, but Ace years later was replaced once again, this time by his guitar tech, Tommy Thayer.
That's right.
Now this
who played him in a Kiss cover band.
Yeah.
And was responsible for teaching Ace his solos, and this I did not find out until much later, teaching Peter how to play drums again.
Oh, I never heard
that. Yeah. And that was apparently the big hang up was that if you listen to Paul's book on tape, the telling of it is pretty hysterical. But they were like a couple weeks in with Ace, he's like, yeah, he's got this, he'll be fine. And a couple, you know, and then there was a phone call with like, Peter can't play drums anymore. What are we going to do? You guys need to know. I've been working with him. This is not happening. And so Tommy comes in not just as a replacement guitar player, but as like kind of a sideline musical director for making the other shit happen.
Yeah.
You know, seriously, you know, and obviously a purist as far as the solos go. So, you know, with that ability to, you know, nail the solos plus.
Well, and in terms of being a purist, this is a weird one to quantify too, because
he's playing Ace in makeup.
Yes, but that is the role he has been cast in.
Yeah.
So there's a lot. You throw the rule book out the window.
Yeah, it's very strange
that you would apply with any other band.
Right.
It's a character, and I submit he's actually succeeding because he is the purist, because he is playing it note for note, so mm-hmm. that if the job that's on the table is, I need you to not only look like Ace, I need you to play like Ace, and that's what you do, then you're doing it. Mm-hmm. You're doing it successfully.
Right.
And this is a band who, that's the objective they're going for now.
Yeah.
They're not trying to reinvent. They're not trying to write a bunch of new music with a different, more contemporary sound, whatever. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to say, hey, we got a, you know, better guitar player technically than somebody yeah. we could have started out with. Because there's a lot, you know, it's obvious that if you got four unknown guys and no money, mm-hmm. then you have a certain amount of resources available to you. If you get lucky, you're going to get some great players. Mm-hmm. But a lot of times what's going to happen is those are the guys that created that original band, and then if the band gets really big, if somebody does leave the band, guess what? There's a line outside the door of the top guys in yeah. the industry trying to get into the band, which means, yeah, technically you're going to upgrade, but it may not be the best thing mm-hmm. in terms of the integrity of the structure.
Yeah, and especially if those guys come in with dollar signs in their eyes and thinking about publishing and all kinds of other stuff
yeah.
instead of, like, I'm here to play a role. And uniquely, like, to be Tommy or even Eric Singer, you got to be constantly reminded every night when you put on the makeup that this is something you weren't there for the impetus of this.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of, I would imagine, you know, I don't feel like it keeps them in check in a down kind of a way, but there's mm-hmm. definitely an aspect of it where that, you know, they're confronted by it
yeah.
before every show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Here's another one. I'll put this in the mixed bag category because right. I think Kiss could certainly fall into that depending on what criteria you're applying to the situation.
Mm-hmm.
But, how about a band that has had not one, not two, but three lead singers, Iron Maiden?
Yeah.
Paul Di'Anno, or rather Bruce Dickinson for Paul Di'Anno.
Yeah.
That's your first switch. That's a success.
Totally.
Di'Anno was great, mm-hmm. and his stuff is still – boy, that's one way, too, you can quantify it is the first – person is their stuff, is their catalog carried over to this day to mm-hmm. the existing you know, worldwide juggernaut that is the success. And in the case of Di'Anno, yes, it is.
Right.
So success there. However, not a success when Bruce Dickinson exited and Blaze Bailey entered.
Right.
That did not work.
No. And again, that is in that ballpark of you know, it's hard to top out a singer like Bruce Dickinson. I mean, mm-hmm. A, you're super distinct, so you've got that kind of sonically distinct like Vince Neil.
Mm-hmm.
But talent-wise, also just top of the arc. There's,
yeah.
you know, that's a real problem.
Yeah.
Like, that's got to be tough. Because there's some bands, I'm sure, where they're like, man, I can't wait to get rid of this fucking guy. He can't do it.
Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of that rolling around.
Mm-hmm.
And in the case of Bruce Dickinson, even if you felt that, you're like, Jesus Christ, how do we replace that?
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There just aren't other people. And that's where I think a lot of these bands, you know, fold and go back to the low res, you know, the 8-bit singer.
Yeah.
After they've had the 4K
yeah,
singer.
Yeah, yeah.
They go, let's go 8-bit. Fuck it.
Yeah.
You know, we'll show them because we can, you
get
know,
back to
have
our
yeah, have our Saint Anger yeah. load moment where we're just, it's just, you know, we don't need all this production and all these great songs and great yeah. sounds. We'll just fart out some stuff and show them how garagey we are. And and in the case of singers, when they do that, and I, you know, it's hard to say where Gary Cherone falls into that.
I was just about to say,
yeah.
we kind of didn't, since we're talking mixed bag
yeah.
of results, we should circle back to Van Halen. Because Gary Cherone's an awesome singer,
yeah.
so there's no issue there. But I would almost blame it on the times,
yes.
except that Van Halen,
yeah.
is bigger than the 80s.
I
mean,
yes,
that,
I agree.
Van Halen is a band that, to me, Van Halen is like a harder rockin' journey in the sense that that's just a band for the ages. That mm-hmm. catalog should be able to play no matter what mm-hmm. year it is, and Journey certainly can. And if Van Halen were more active, I certainly feel like they'd be doing it now.
Right.
Whether it be with Roth or
with Hagar. Right.
But for some reason, maybe it's just they didn't stick with them long enough. I mean, maybe if it hadn't just been the one record.
There's a huge deal going from David Lee Roth, who was famous with the original band and a classic rock singer because of it, to Sammy Hagar, who being with Montrose and having the hit with I Can't Drive 55, yeah. which was this bar-friendly, invigorating crossover hit for most rock fans. Like, there's nothing to hate on that song. You know what I mean? It's just like, yeah, good for you, man. That's it. There's no, like, oh, I fucking hate that. You know, there was no Nickelback backlash towards I Can't Drive 55. You know what I mean? It was right in line with sort of a rocking or more higher-pitched ZZ Top tune. You know what I mean? And those driving songs around that idea. It was the Smokey and the Bandit of songs.
No, that's a very good point. Yeah. Because with Sharon, even though Extreme had a hit, it had a couple of hits, even though they did, by and large, to the general music-consuming public, you were still having to introduce Gary Sharon to those people. You didn't have to introduce Sammy Hagar to the music consumer.
And had they, it's interesting, Paul Rodgers. If they'd had somebody like Paul Rodgers join Van Halen and sing to some degree, there'd have been one of those like, oh, they got this class. They got the guy from Bad Company is singing for Van Halen now. There's something to that where you're like, oh, shit.
They bring this that cachet.
Yeah, it would have.
And they've already been on top on their own or with another band.
They
had to
equal out Eddie and all that weird side stories of Eddie being a wreck and, you know, scoring porn, you know, for a little while with his guitar. Like whatever gig would come along, kind of odd storylines that were going on about him. And then back to the scientist, the mad scientist Eddie, which is now who's back with us in a lot of ways, creating amplifiers and driving the, you know, the whole EVH empire and really doing it. Like that's the, his gear is the shit, is awesome. So, which since we're talking, you know, we're going to try to stay away from, you know, singers, you know, and I want to kind of finish up with the Aussie guitar players. Because in the case of, you had almost every circumstance with each of the replacements, with the main replacements with Aussie. Because he's had a couple of stunt people like, you know, Buckethead and other people who've done some tours. But we're really talking about Randy Rhodes to Jakey Lee to Zakk Wylde. Like that, those are legitimate transitions. Because, and again, Jake walks into something where the guy has died and is iconic, and you have to recreate those solos, and creates his own version of stuff with Ozzy. Co-writes a lot of those songs, you know, Ultimate Sin and Shot in the Dark and those kind
of
songs.
He was a big part of Bark at the Moon.
Bark at the Moon, that riff, holy shit. Like, that's where you had a guitar player coming in as the replacement guy who created some of the most definitive riffs of all time.
That's a great... Okay, so let me tell you something about that.
Yeah.
That, again, given my age, Randy Rhodes was a few years before my time. So the first time, first of many times I saw Ozzy Osbourne was with Jakey Lee. But what I remember about Jakey Lee was he was the first guy that I identified as this larger-than-life presence in someone else's solo band. Okay, so not a band name. Not
Van Halen. Or even Tony Iommi and Black Sabbath,
right,
for example.
Not that. But a band that's named for a guy, Ozzy Osbourne. So it's the Ozzy Osbourne Show. It's, you're essentially saying right there on the marquee, it's this guy and his backup band. And somebody in that backup band is himself this larger-than-life persona. Jakey Lee was that to me and my friends who were just learning to play our instruments and all that kind of stuff, not only because of his sound and his presence, but I even remember going to see them on the Ultimate Sin tour, and Jakey Lee had his own T-shirt at the merch stand. That was unheard of. I got one. I was like, this is crazy. One of the guys in the backup band has his own merch.
Yeah.
You know?
I just remember like the Bark at the Moon riff when it starts. When that first single came out, it was one of those situations where after Randy died, is it all over?
Mm-hmm.
Is Ozzy going to have to go back to Black Sabbath mm-hmm. for his own thing? Is he going to just kind of shut down for a while? And, you know, or will there just be this limp by of, oh, he's going to be playing Crazy Train and some other mm-hmm. stuff with some stunt guys for a while and stuff. And then he comes out and Jake, just that riff,
mm-hmm.
just and the solos themselves.
He kept the momentum going.
Oh, my God. Which, so awesome.
And later on, so did Zach.
Yes.
Because now Zach, there's another guy who is a larger-than-life character. And in honestly, nowadays, because of Ozzy's advancing age and declining health and voice and all that, he needs a guy like that.
Yes, he does.
Because now it's like he helps prop him up. Like he's a valuable asset of mm-hmm. that show. And, you know, he's not only in his crazy Viking look and all that, mm-hmm. but, you know, Black Label Society and Zach Sabbath. I mean, he's his own thing.
Yes.
It's like Ozzy Osbourne featuring. You know, even though the marquee doesn't say that, it feels
like it.
It's like
Ozzy was comfortable sharing space. It's the same way, you know, David Lee Roth was with Steve Vai after, you know, because I loved the Skyscraper record. I loved Eat 'Em and Smile. I like that era of Roth. I love David Lee Roth's energy, you know, when it's at full force.
Uh-huh.
And I love Steve Vai.
Yeah.
And so Steve Vai, in many ways, was he really the replacement for Eddie Van Halen in some ways? Where Van Halen, yeah, it's still got the name Van Halen, but is that really a split up of a band?
Mm-hmm.
And just because, you know, would we have been in a Rat featuring situation if Van Halen wasn't Eddie's name?
Yeah.
You know, if David Lee Roth had gone off with that and they had the, you know, it was the DLR band from day one,
mm-hmm.
would have ultimately Steve Vai been the replacement guy for Eddie Van Halen in that regard, and I would say yes. And there's so much to both those records, you know, the riff on Going Crazy and that kind of stuff that stood out. And I think both Roth and Ozzy, as big as they are, were launch factories for a lot of people to create, mm-hmm. you know, themselves. They didn't chew the scenery. They mm-hmm. did, you know, they were huge. I mean, Ozzy is iconic world over, but the guys on stage with them were not invisible
mm-hmm.
because of that. You know, Trujillo played with him before he played with Metallica, mm-hmm. for example. And, you know, Ozzy's been rotating, you know, drummers and bass players, like, who cares?
Yeah.
But when it comes to the lead guitar player, he was always comfortable sharing that space. And I remember the videos of him with Jakey Lee Live where he's like pulling Jake's hair mm-hmm. while he's soloing just to fuck with him.
Mm-hmm.
And that energy on stage seemed symbiotic and valuable.
I think Ozzy figured out that largely because of Randy Rhoads, that there was going to be a space for him and an expectation that he was going to be the guitar kingmaker.
Yes.
He was going to be the launcher of guitar virtuosos. Mm-hmm. And so, therefore, whoever was in that spot can't just be a background guy. He's got to be the next thing
And he absolutely, you know, did. Like I said, Jake's stuff is classic sonically to me in many ways. And then when Zach came in, like, I think, you know, just Miracle Man, Fire in the Sky, the solos on, you know, Breaking All the Rules. Mm-hmm. The No Rest for the Wicked record is probably the most unsung Ozzy record mm-hmm. of all time.
Mm-hmm.
And largely only because, you know, A, of Crazy Train and the original stuff, but also because No More Tears was such a huge mm-hmm. element or whatever, and Zach was a part of that. And Zach, as this, like, young, blonde, beach-looking, muscle-bound guy in his leather pants that looked like something David Lee Roth would wear. Mm-hmm. He looked much more like David Lee Roth with a guitar than he looked like, you know, Eric of the Mountain like he does now. But there's definitely, you know, like when he showed up and his hair would never stop swinging and he could still play. Mm-hmm. And when he sang, he sounded like he was an exact replica of Ozzy for the stuff. So it sounded like a great double.
Yeah.
And he could sing high enough to harmonize and he had respect for Randy, which I think still shines through when he talks
mm-hmm.
about it.
Mm-hmm.
He had so much respect for both Randy and Jake that he nails those solos. He adds his ping flavor that he likes to his little pinch harmonics, but the solos are there. It's not like him fucking them off and going, I'm the guy now.
Yeah.
It's like, no, 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 no. Those are parts of the songs, and I'm going to make them come back alive for you.
Yeah.
And that gave him so much more room then to have his own style within it. You know what I mean?
That's nobody, a great point.
Nobody hated him. He did not run into a Cliff Burton situation, you know, a Jason Newsted moment for himself, because he came in and didn't. I mean, A, he's gigantic, so that helps immensely, I think. But this, you know, throughput, like, again, that through line is really the important thing. So our message to any bands that might be listening to this for reference in the future, 1,000 years from now, if you are replacing somebody, you have to have somebody who can play the catalog as well as your first singer or your first guitar player or your first bass player or drummer, and bring something so extraordinarily new that they... And if they can't, because that person is so iconic, they simply have to nail what that person did in makeup and go home.
Yeah.
That's it. I mean, it's really... It boils down to, in those situations, there are only really two wins.
Yeah.
Everything else is going to be an utter fail, even if the person is talented, even if the Paul Rogers and the Gary Sharons of the world are valuable musicians in their own right. Unless they can come in and, A, nail what the previous person that made that thing iconic, nail it, not no wavering, or nail it plus. Nothing else will do.
Yeah.
And you can get away with just nailing it. You can get away with just, you know, being Tommy Thayer and going, I'm going to kill this.
Yeah.
This is going to be exactly like what you want. But if you can come in and you can, with like commercial success, like Phil Collins did with Genesis, and up-level them, if you can be Ronnie James Dio and Sabbath and create kind of your own sonic empire within that, if you can come in as Sammy Hagar and go, yeah, I can sing those songs, but I'm also sonically able to do this.
Because another real possibility on the other side of that coin is somebody could look at your performance and say, this is an amazing player who is a totally wrong fit for this band.
Yes, right, and it makes me hate coming here. Yeah, and I will, and I hate this person for being really good and wrong,
and in the wrong band.
What a fucking horrible situation to be in. You're like, and I guarantee there's both singers and guitar players, mainly, maybe a few bass players too, or definitely some drummers, but that have been in bands where like, I'm way better than that fucking piece of shit, and then they go up there and they're just, you know, triple timing some stuff, or they're playing trills where there are none, and the people in the audience are going, what the fuck, what do you think you're doing? You know, I hate you now, you know, for you going, I'm gonna go and lay waste with the old guy that they had in this band. I'll fucking eat his lunch. And everybody's like, why are you eating my favorite person's lunch?
Yeah.
You're stealing food off the table of my favorite artist.
Yeah, 100%.
It's a tough one. That's the replacement aspect.
All right. I'll adjourn the court if we're
absolutely. I mean, we definitely dealt with the main ones that I was thinking about, but I want everybody to go and listen to some of these bands. Listen to go check out the replacements we were talking about. Listen to that, some of that Paul Rogers Queen that we're talking about, and Gary Sharon and Van Halen, the single that they did. Kind of, you know, you'll see what we're talking about. And then go listen to some like early Genesis, you know, with Peter Gabriel and then Phil Collins, and see if that's a transition you can do with. And then, of course, get the Ozzy and the Kiss catalog, and get the Blue Murder record, because God damn it.
Yeah.
Other than that, I have no opinion.
Hey guys, if you're enjoying the Double Neck Download podcast, 3 episodes in, do us a very big favor, will you? Actually, do us 2 very big favors. Won't cost you a thing, either one of them. First thing is, look us up on iTunes, Double Neck Download in iTunes, and click on those 5 stars. Give us the 5-star rating. That is going to help us qualify for an official average rating and get us higher up in the rankings and the searches and all that sort of thing, so more metalheads can find the Double Neck Download podcast just like you have. Second thing, very much along the lines of the first thing, tell a friend. If you have a friend who is a fan of hard rock, metal, or just good conversation, then let them know Double Neck Download is for them. You've gotten turned on to it, and now you want to pass along the good news. So give us those 5 stars in iTunes, and most importantly, tell a friend that you want to, whose life you want to make better, about the Double Neck Download podcast. That's going to do it for this week. We'll be right back next week with a brand new episode, all new topics. And that's it. So for Hal Sparks, I'm Richard Hunter. We appreciate you guys tuning in to the Double Neck Download.